Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ralph Casa, the president of the Pacific Forum, CSIS. We're the lucky part of CSIS. We're located in Honolulu instead of inside the Beltway. But we're absolutely delighted to be here in Washington on a Hawaii-style day. We take full credit for bringing the Hawaiian weather with us to this meeting. We're absolutely delighted to have as our guest of honor today and our speaker, private citizen Fidel Ramos, but some of you may remember him from some previous duties, to include president of the Philippines from 1992 to 1998. Literally the man who led the nation out of darkness, we can say, if those of you who recall the Philippines back in those days, where you wouldn't dare get on a high-rise elevator for fear that a power outage would strike you. And one of the first things that President Ramos did was get the electricity under order and then work on improving the life of the people in the Philippines. And now he's continuing to do that, not just in the Philippines, but throughout East Asia. In addition to heading the Ramos Peace and Development Foundation, he's also chairman of the BOA Forum for Asia, trying to promote some closer multilateral cooperation. He is going to be focusing, I think, his remarks on the broader regional cooperation and certainly on U.S.-China relations and how it impacts Asia, although I've warned him that there will be lots of questions, I'm sure, on domestic activities in the Philippines as well, and he has very graciously agreed to doing a Q&A session after he finishes his prepared remarks. So you're not here to listen to me, you're here to listen to him, so let me at this point just invite President Ramos to take the stage. Mr. President.
Thank you, Dr. Ralph Casa, for your very kind introduction. Before we begin, let me greet you from the Philippines with a rousing Mabuhay! Mabuhay means many things to Filipinos, but literally that means there is life. May buhay, there is life. Which means may you have good health, long life, happy birthday, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Mother's Day, and Happy Mother-in-Law's Day. Please do not forget her. Having said that, in the spirit of Mabuhay, may I ask you nice people to just reach out to your right and left and back and forth across the rows and just shake the hand of that person that you find there. Over there. There you go. And having done that, again in the spirit of Mabuhay, Philippine style, will you please embrace each other? Yeah, come on, come on, come on. This is the way we do it. This is people power. There you go. There's some ladies over here. There's my former ghostwriter over there. And now you may exchange business cards. But if you have no business cards, you may exchange pocketbooks. Ralph, these are full of pesos. dear friends, I am delighted to be here and to be again in CSIS, which is not unfamiliar to me, having been invited here, I think, a couple of times in the past. And it has always been an enlightening experience to exchange views with you, the experts who are here. I was told that I'm expected to give a speech. Of course, I don't have a speech. But that doesn't mean that I'm not ready. Because as a good soldier, you must always have some ammunition in your pocket. And so today I hope to speak about China the U.S. and the Asia Pacific. And I'm taking off from the recent visit of President Hu Jintao to the U.S., which was his first official state visit to this country. On the 19th to the 23rd of April. And the highlight of that was his summit meeting with your President George Bush here in Washington, D.C. All of this, which was accompanied by a lot of advanced publicity from both sides, including for us, the third countries in the Asia Pacific, creating great expectations on both sides of the Pacific. It was, according to Newsweek, of that period, going to be a war of wills, a war of the heavyweights, a war of the titans. And according to U.S. analysts, the main issues were supposed to be, and there are three of these. Number one, peace and security with human rights in the forefront. Because in the opinion of the U.S. public, human rights must not be trampled upon under the label of fighting terrorism through crackdowns on peaceful expressions of religious, cultural, or ethnic groups, or unlawful detentions. Second, trade and finance, especially the floating of the yuan, and correcting the great U.S.-China trade imbalance. And third, according again to the U.S. media, advancing freedoms, which may come under threat because of China's state-of-the-art censorship and surveillance, put in place principally by foreign companies, ironically, also U.S. companies. And I understand, looking at CNN very early this morning at Atlanta, that's a big issue here in the U.S., but that's only coincidental. Now, on the part of the Chinese, quoting Beijing's Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman, Qin Gang, he affirmed that it will be the Taiwan question which will be the most important and the most sensitive core issue in the discussions between Mr. Hu Jintao and Mr. Bush during that state visit. And also likely to be taken up would be, still quoting China sources, trade, intellectual property, and currency issues. Now, as may have been mentioned to you earlier, I am often in China for the sake of pursuing the interests of our Ramos Peace and Development Foundation, which is non-government, non-stock, non-profit, non-political, non-partisan, but just serves as, I think, CSIS does, as a track-to mechanism to support government and people. Since government cannot do everything all by itself. Now, from my encounters in China, especially as chairman of the Boao Forum for Asia, which was founded by 26 Asian countries, but includes the whole world in terms of intellectual exchange, and that is also non-government and non-political. According to my information, China claims to be actively pursuing balanced and harmonious development domestically while it promotes peaceful cooperation and opens up its economy to the world. As repeatedly pointed out by President Hu Jintao himself and Premier Wen Jiabao, and both have been our main speakers at the Boao Forum for Asia looking at the last 4 years. China's pursuit of peaceful development is determined by China's national conditions, which is rooted in China's history, tradition, and culture. And this is highlighted by her huge population, spread out over a vast country, of which only one-third, believe it or not, is arable. And in keeping with global trends in development. And they are consistent in stating that indeed China has grown in strength. But this has resulted, according to them, in creating more opportunities for China's neighbors and for China's economy as well as the global environment. There are all kinds of statistics that China puts up for everybody's appreciation, especially China's imports to Asian countries that totaled some $440 billion last year, growing by 20% as an average over the last 5 years, looking at year on year. And so the question is, when does China surpass the U.S. as the world's first superpower? There are all kinds of speculations, of course, from both sides of the Pacific. But in a conference in Shenzhen last year, and the question was raised, one eminent Chinese professor stopped all the discussion with one comment, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, China has always been the world's first superpower. So you don't have to worry about when it will happen in 2030, 2040, or 2050. We have always been the world's first superpower, except during the last 200 years. And so I think that would indicate to all of us, at least that is how it impacted on us there in Shenzhen, the long-term ambitions of China. And of course, that must be carefully monitored and carefully analyzed so that we all, as friends and neighbors, can make the right decisions vis-a-vis China. Now, last week at the annual conference of the Bao Forum, which I chaired, not 3 weeks ago, the Vice President of China was there as our main speaker. This is Vice President Chen Qinghong. Mr. Hu Jintao was invited again, but he could not make it because he was here. And Vice President Cheng reiterated China's long-term commitment to Asian intra-regional cooperation and in exploring effective ways to achieve mutual benefit and win-win outcomes for all Asian countries. The mantra that is mentioned by all of China's leaders now is peaceful rise. The rise, I think, is a given. The peaceful, which looks that way at this point, must be monitored and evaluated by all in accordance with each country's national interest very, very carefully. I am told that I am given about 20 minutes for this presentation so that we can have a longer open forum, and I agree with that. And so, Ralph, thank you for some of the notes you gave me, but I shall dispose of them where they belong because this is all of 60 minutes, you see. So. You can download that from the CSS website. Now, what else did Vice President Zhang say? He said that The 11th National Economic and Social Development Plan, or NESDP of China, recently approved in their recently concluded 10th National Congress, envisions the pursuit of a scientific outlook on development and the building of a harmonious society that will advance the interests of all social groups in China in a balanced way for also the mutual benefit and common development of Asia and the rest of the world. That term, harmonious development, or people's harmony, crops up very often in the statements of China's leaders these days. And maybe that is because there are now a growing number of protests in China over jobs, land, rights of way, the environment, etc. And not too long ago, the chief of the National Police of China reported to us in the Boa Forum that they recorded some 90,000 protests during the year 2004, big or small, maybe not as big as the ones in Manila, which are big enough, but the ones in Bangkok are bigger than Manila, and some others are bigger than Bangkok. But anyway, that's what he said, and we were all surprised that there was such an admission. But Time and Newsweek magazine are now reporting the protests of farmers and women in Guangdong province over the price of land being bought by government for infrastructure development or just non-compensation for this and that, as well as pollution issues. Anyway, Vice President Zhang identified 3 points of harmonious engagement that he wanted us to remember to promote common and sustainable development in East Asia. First, he said, deepen mutually beneficial cooperation to promote common and sustainable development. Well, that's an old song. Second, uphold harmonious coexistence with respect and protection for the diversity of our cultures in the region and around the world. Again, this is a very familiar statement. And third, continue to be inclusive and open to the whole world. So there's not much that's new here with your respect to Vice President Chung. But he did end it by saying that, as an ancient Chinese saying goes, and I quote him, the ocean is vast and deep because it admits all rivers, unquote. I think you have bigger rivers here in the U.S., no? Okay. Now, what about China and the U.S.? As I said, the annual conference in the Boa Forum for Asia on Hainan Island. Boa is one of their big resort cities over there. Coincided with the state visit of President Hu Jintao to the U.S. 3 weeks ago. By the way, some of you have been to Boa, but to describe that more accurately and graphically, in Boao, because it is at the same latitude as Honolulu and Pangasinan province in the Philippines, where I come from, the dress code is casual, informal, and minimal, because we are on a 25-mile long beach, you know, with all kinds of recreational facilities, 2 18-hole, 5-star golf courses, tennis courts, etc., etc. Unlike in some other world forums, where the venue is on top of the Alps during winter time. And one has to be either an Eskimo or a polar bear, you know, to appreciate those meetings and conferences, because you're always fighting for your own survival. It's just too cold up there. I won't mention any names, but I'm pushing our forum, so please come next year. We do, by the way, 7 or 8 side conferences on various issues. Supply chain management, CEO forums, energy, environment, education, culture, and lately the terrorism situation. Anyway, here in the U.S., I'm hearing, and I'm quoting Dr. Farid Zakaria, senior Newsweek editor, who claims, and I think he is correct, the most strategic decision Washington will make in the next decade is not about Iraq, nor Iran, nor North Korea, but it will be about China. And similarly, the most strategic decision that Beijing will make in the next decade is how to relate to the United States. The question of China's so-called peaceful rise, as I said, has engaged the experts on both sides of the Pacific, including ours in our area. And there are those, especially here in the U.S., who argue that confrontation is inevitable between China and the U.S., with the U.S. at this time trying hard to contain China. And they conclude that China must therefore build up its position in Asia and the world in order to respond from a position of strength. And in this regard, predictably, President Hu Jintao mounted a charm offensive in the U.S. and gained a lot of public relations points by ordering 80 Boeing 737 airliners worth $4.6 billion, courting Bill Gates' Microsoft for closer partnership in information technology in China, and also kissing babies in Seattle, which is a U.S. and Philippine election campaign gimmick. On the other hand, President George W. Bush, in the aftermath of the Ho visit, according to your media, remains bogged down in Iraq war issues, the Iran nuclear showdown problem, and his alleged declining approval ratings down to about 32%, which is his lowest in years. But on balance, and this is our position in the Philippines, speaking as just a private sector representative, it is cooperation, not confrontation, which is the preferred mode. And I think this is also the preferred mode here in the U.S. Many of us, many Americans, admire China for her economic success and commend Beijing for producing what can only be called an economic miracle. In fact, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick claims that it is still American policy, and I now quote him, "It is still American policy to support a strong and growing China, but it is also one that pushes Beijing to use its growing power in beneficial ways so that China becomes a responsible stakeholder in the international system." There are also other analysts, dear friends, that already China and the U.S. have together agreed on a so-called resilient web of common interests that will act to constrain their strategic competition. As well as there are lessons of history that will prevent any recklessness from either side in this nuclear age. Meantime, China and the U.S. are feverishly engaged in a race to explore for gas and oil, in research for alternative means of energy, as well as gobbling up existing and foreseeable reserves of energy in various parts of the world. And what probably irritates the U.S., this is just my personal opinion, most in this regard, is China's aggressiveness in courting some countries that are not so good looking to the West, such as Iran and Sudan, which are big oil producers. In fact, President Hu Jintao's sorties on the heels of his U.S. visit 3 weeks ago were to Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Morocco, and Kenya, which proves this conclusion. Now, for its part, the Philippines should exploit new opportunities in the search for alternative energy resources in partnership both with China and the U.S. This is ongoing, by the way, in the Philippines by both countries. And in the case of China, believe it or not, the oil and gas exploration is being jointly done with Vietnam, China, and the Philippines in the disputed islands of the South Pacific called the Spratlys, which was a no-no not too long ago by China. He didn't want any other country in there to explore for gas and oil. But we're all there, three countries. So, in a way, the world is changing. You might even say that China is moderating. Now, what are the implications of what I've told you for the Philippines? For me, it is politically wise and economically beneficial to the Philippines to adhere closely to the so-called One China policy while reserving the right of the Philippines to engage Taiwan on a strictly economic, commercial, and cultural partnership. In regard to the United States, Philippine policy should continue to maintain constructive networking and partnership, especially in defense, security, including anti-terrorism, and trade issues on the basis of existing treaties and agreements. And towards all, the Philippines must reach out in more creative ways beyond the migration of overseas workers, maybe up higher in the professional level. And it will be people-to-people engagements on the part of the Philippines at that higher professional level that will work so well for us, especially in education, business, finance, engineering, and other services. And this could gain many advantages for the Philippines in the next 10 years. But, and I must confess to you, I'm reading from my column in the Manila Bulletin 2 Sundays ago. But, I say, before the Philippines can gain such greater advantages, first of all, and this is a Sunday column, meaning it is a homily to the local audience and to the local leaders. Put it in that context. I say, but, first of all, our elected leaders in Congress and in Malacanang and our court should put the Philippine House in order so that ordinary Filipinos can benefit more and more from our God-given natural resources and strategic geopolitical position. Our most urgent problem in the Philippines is the widening gap between the rich and the poor, aggravated by incessant political wrangling, unmitigated corruption, and the lack of united resolve on the part of our elected leaders in Malacanang and in Congress to move the Philippines fast forward. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, there is more on the website of CSIS. I conclude, and I thank you, and open the floor for any questions that you may have.
Please, if you wouldn't mind, identify yourself when you ask the question and try to resist the temptation of giving a 20-minute speech. Just give a quick question, sir.
You want to have that?
General Ramos. Working? Is this working? Mike Billington from Executive Intelligence Review.
Mike, I can't hear you. Will you kindly come over here and say it to me here?
You don't want this microphone? Is it working?
No. We senior citizens are hard of hearing, you know. Right.
In response to the opening statement about your role in energy.
Photographer, get ready. This is really a photo, so. Now, get ready.
You should wait to hear what I say first.
Yeah, it's okay. Did you get it? Okay.
You probably know that Rani Velasco, the energy minister during the Marcos years, has recently written a book after these long 20 years, sort of a memoir of his time. And as you might, I have a review of that book in my current issue of EIR. You might imagine your name shows up quite often. I'd like to ask about two aspects of that that are related. One is that in regard to the nuclear power plant, which he was the primary promoter of, he says that the plant, which was ready to be turned on in November of 85, was not turned on because of an intervention from the U.S., from Secretary of State Shultz and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz through Danforth, the ambassador at that time, with whom you were meeting regularly before the military operations in February. And I'd like to know what you have to say in your role in stopping that nuclear plant. He then goes on and says that when you became president, that the vast shortage of electricity, which he accredits largely to the fact that that nuclear plant was never turned on, was used to justify an emergency ruling from the Congress, which gave you the power to sign contracts without any oversight, which you did with many foreign power companies, and which were of the sort of unequal treaties in the sense that it imposed the risk on the Philippines, where they had to buy all the electricity in dollar denominations, which in the...
We could be just a little more precise.
Yeah, I got it.
In the 97-98 financial attack on the peso, that led to a very severe near bankruptcy of the Philippines. So I'd like you to, how do you plead on these charges? And also, if you could comment on your current relations with Shultz and others who are sort of the godfathers of the Bush-Cheney administration today.
Other than that.
Well, I want you to know I met with former Secretary of State George Shultz just last week in Sacramento. I was meeting with the Filipino community and the Filipino war veterans of World War II there. And on my way to Sacramento, I got a call that I must drop by the state house. And I did. And believe it or not, there was former Secretary George Shultz, who, as you insinuated, is a very dear friend, because of our playing golf together, not because of any political or business associations. And the reason why it was known in Sacramento that I would be there is that it turns out that his wife, Mrs. Charlotte Shultz, is the chief of protocol for the state of California. So aside from the young couple, there was the governor of California. waiting at the gate of his state residence. And as we shook hands with Governor Arnold, he said, "Hey, Mr. Ramos, you almost broke my hand." Well, anyway. But to go back to the question, I think there is some misreporting or misrepresentation here. I don't know exactly what Ronnie Velasco said. But he must remember that in the contracting for the 600 megawatt nuclear power plant on Bataan, and this was mainly with an American company, that many people, including media at that time, claimed the lack of transparency. And that's to be expected. This was still during Strongman Rule, 1985. Now, he also forgets that it was during the time of President Aquino, before my time as president, that contract was canceled because it had been accompanied by such suspicion of graft, corruption, fraud, and, you know, under-the-table arrangements. I don't know if you ever mentioned that. But what happened with the cancellation of 600 megawatts of electric power on our main island grid of Luzon, without any replacement whatsoever, was a critical shortage of electric power starting in Metro Manila itself and then eventually in the bigger cities of Luzon and eventually throughout the whole country, that averaged from 8 to 10 daily brownouts starting in 1989. So all of this was the effect of the cancellation by President Aquino of that contract. The result of that was 2 years of brownouts, very severe, brought our economy down to about zero growth, looking at 1991 and early 1992. But not just because of the brownouts, but also because of the so many coup attempts during that period from 86 to 1992, first half. And so as the incoming president, mid-1992, I had to do many things in a hurry. And first priority was given to restoring the lights. I asked for various reform laws to be enacted by Congress very quickly. First of all, the reestablishment or the reorganization or the reconstitution of the Department of Energy, which was dismantled by President Aquino during her time as revolutionary president, because she had a revolutionary government and she was ruling by decree. Congress was not yet in session for 17 months after February 25, 1986. And so the Ministry or the Department of Energy was established by Act of Congress December 1992, my time. After that, we expanded the existing BOT law, Build, Operate, Transfer law, so that it could apply not only to engineering works, roads and bridges, but also to energy infrastructures, power plants, transmission lines, and also submarine cables connecting the various island grids. And it was on that basis that we were able to attract a lot of foreign players, big ones, in the energy sector. And therefore, within 18 months after I assumed as president, indeed the lights went on again all over the whole country. But it was in the water sector where I asked for emergency powers by law. Because of the, by the way, I'm giving you an article here on water. You can do this too. This will be published in Manila on Sunday. So I'm giving an advance copy. Anyway, we're always ahead of you in the U.S. Yeah, in terms of the dateline. So no embargo on this one. You can quote it anytime. Anyway, using the BOT law, or the expanded BOT law, we could get into various other configurations with the investors or developers, as we call them. We had the BOT, bid operate transfer, and then we had the BTO. This was especially applicable to the energy sector. And then we had the BO, just build and operate, no transfer after the concession period. And then we also had BOOM, or BOM, build, operate, maintain. That's a lesser investment cost because you maintain ownership. And then we also had BOOM. Boom! Boom, boom, boom! Build, operate, own, and manage, etc., etc. And we have ROL, repair, the old one, especially hydro and coal, operate, and then lease back to the National Power Corporation. It was like that in the energy sector. The emergency law on water, by the way, had a terminal date. So after we built some big dams and resolved Manila's water supply problem temporarily for the midterm, the authority terminated. So I'd like to make that very clear, because you must understand my situation at the time. We had inherited a country that was growing at zero growth, less than $10 billion worth of international reserves, just gone through at least 9 coup attempts in a 6-year period, or an average of 1 coup attempt, some of them very bloody, every 8 months. And with due respect to President Cory Aquino, my former boss, I think she did a good job in bringing back democracy. But then the rest of us, her successors, had to carry on in terms of the economy. And that is what I pursued very religiously, call it, during my 6 years. But of course, nation building here as well as in the Philippines must be done successively, because no country can be built up in the short span of 6 years or 8 years here. It's like building a house. I know how to build a house. I'm a civil engineer by profession with the license to practice. You start with strong democratic foundations on solid rock, and then you put in the important structural components, especially utilities for the family in the case of a home, for the country in the case of a country, to enjoy electric power, water, clean air, communications, transportation, health, education, etc., before you even start thinking of the master's bedroom. Unfortunately, in the Philippines, well, never mind, that's another story. But,
President Ramos, you've been part of the ASEAN Eminent Persons Group. You've been meeting with the ASEAN Eminent Persons in Indonesia, I believe, in the last month or so. Could you give us an idea of what the eminent persons are recommending as a vision for the ASEAN leaders, and also how will ASEAN relate to China? You talked about the U.S.-China relationship, but what about the ASEAN-China relationship? Thank you.
The eminent persons group in ASEAN is really eminent persons who represent themselves, one per country. We don't represent the government. And our mandate from the leaders, meaning the incumbents, as a decision from their last summit in KL last December, is to review all of the major agreements in ASEAN over the last 38 years and then put out the broad guidelines in terms of principles, values, objectives, institutions, conflict resolution mechanisms, etc. And they came out with a battle cry, so to speak, at that summit, which is one vision, one identity, one community. But for myself, I said one community is not enough. Because if we're looking at the global environment, we must make sure that we also have some political unity of some kind. Without trying to copy the EU or the US, I said we must add one more goal to that battle cry of ours suggested by the leaders. Should be one vision, one identity, one community, one union. But to be defined in the charter over time to be achieved. And so that's how it stands now. In our third meeting in Bali 3 weeks ago, middle of April, the one union thing was tentatively agreed to by the other EPGs, but of course subject to review by experts and eventually the leaders. The important thing about the ASEAN Charter is really to establish the juridical and legal identity of ASEAN, which right now is a loose organization created in Bangkok 39 years ago on the basis of Musyawara Mufakat, meaning dialogue or consultation, and then consensus. But the consensus, of course, does not work anymore, where members have to abide by the rules, and that is the nature of the 21st century economy, or even political relationship. That's the way it is in the United Nations now. And so we have tried to develop or discover mechanisms to enforce the rules that will be coming out from this ASEAN Charter eventually, as well as to compel obedience or compliance from among member states who do not obey the rules. But we're now, as EPGs, just in the process of consulting. Our next meeting as EPGs is due end of June in Singapore. In the meantime, each national EPG is busy consulting his or her respective civil society representatives. Because ASEAN, henceforth, although it has always tried to be, must not only be people-centered, but also people-empowered. Meaning, ordinary people must be made, or at least to be made to feel that there are stakeholders in ASEAN, and it is not just the ministers or the leaders or the officials who own it. No, it must be the people. We hope to submit our broad guidelines proposals at the Leaders Summit in Cebu on mid-December this year. And from there on, the details will be worked out by the experts. Now, on ASEAN plus China, I think you're aware that also in the last summit, it is the ASEAN plus China network that is the basic mechanism of ASEAN towards the other countries in East Asia, to which China has agreed. Meaning, it's not APEC, it's not EAS, East Asia Summit, in which there are so many players, by the way, if looking at last December, because Russia, New Zealand, Australia, India, I think Pakistan as observer also came in. But all of ASEAN plus China agreed it will be the ASEAN plus China format that will be the basis for the expansion of this initial economic grouping and then hopefully political cooperation network. So we're looking, this being done now, at ASEAN plus China plus one, and that's Japan. Plus one more, and hopefully that will be, in time, a unified Korea, North and South together, without the nuclear weapons threats. And very clearly, India wants to come in as ASEAN plus four. And that's also being worked out. And since ASEAN already has 540 million people, by itself, it is a heavyweight in East Asia. And if we can put ASEAN plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one, then you have an economic pillar consisting of Asia and the Asia-Pacific nations, to include Australia and New Zealand, that is as strong, if not more so, as the two other pillars of the global economy. And these are the EU with 25 countries, and what President Bush calls the Grand Alliance of the Americas. He said this in Montreal in the year 2003, putting together NAFTA, CAFTA, and all the other organizations in South America. I'm sorry, I had to give you a very long answer to your short question, but...
Stanley Roth, the Boeing Company, and welcome back to Washington, Mr. President. First, on behalf of Boeing, thank you.
I can't hear you. Yes, my old buddy, you know.
Great to see you again, sir. Yeah, I have many of these pictures from our government days, respectively.
Come on, go ahead and ask.
Okay. The question is, I think it would be very useful to this group if you could give us your sense of how Asia is viewing the United States presence in the region. There's a lot of debate, some of it partisan, to be frank, in this country, some not, about whether the United States is seen as withdrawing, that we're focused on the Middle East, we're focused on our problems at home, drawing down troops in Korea, transferring troops to the Middle East, restructuring in Japan, and that meanwhile, China, everywhere you go, they're active on the diplomatic front, lots of Chinese initiatives, their leaders take the kind of trips you refer to. United States, we don't show up when we make brief trips. A lot of people saying Asia's hedging its bets, looking to China as the future, looking at the United States as a declining power. I think it would be very useful for us to get a neutral, nonpartisan view, how you think Asia's viewing the U.S. presence in the region.
I'm glad you see me as neutral. I have analyzed the situation and I put it in an article in the Far Eastern Economic Review, looking at about a year ago, in regard to the security umbrella over the Asia and the Pacific. Right now, as it has been in Europe, it is the U.S. military presence that has guaranteed the peace, security, and stability of our Asia-Pacific region since World War II. And in spite of insurgencies here and there and big wars during that period, it is the U.S. military presence that has guaranteed that we do not all try to destroy each other. And this is what is called in our region Pax Americana, the peace guaranteed by the force of military and diplomatic influence coming from the U.S. In this article, I speak of, and I pass this on to the Secretariat, and those that are interested may have a copy. I'm sorry, the print is not so good, because I had this faxed from my office the other night into a home-based machine in Atlanta belonging to my sister-in-law. Some pages didn't come out very well, but I think you'll get the drift of this. I'm saying that it is time that the nations in the Asia-Pacific, including the U.S. and Canada as Pacific powers, and also Australia and New Zealand, study the need for a new kind of security umbrella for the Asia-Pacific. And that I would like to call Pax Asia Pacifica, which does not exclude the U.S. I'm only saying that if you look at the realities globally, the U.S. is so heavily committed in Iraq to the extent maybe of what? $60-70 billion a year just for the maintenance of the military over there. Not to speak of the reconstruction costs within your $460 billion Pentagon budget. Huge cost, huge burden on the taxpayers. And we're also seeing your higher, greater demand here in the U.S. for more effective homeland security, because you're no longer satisfied with the Ready Reserve and National Guard divisions. And this was written before Typhoon or Hurricane Katrina. And the need for, of course, discovering, accosting, interdicting, and preventing the Al-Qaeda types from threatening and then attacking your country, which is an attack on us also if that happens. And the beyond Iraq, the expanding commitments of the U.S. elsewhere. There are the peacekeeping forces in so many new countries, Nigeria, we are there also, Haiti, continuing in Kosovo, etc., we are there. So with all of that, plus China emerging and Japan finally able to make up its mind about fielding its so-called self-defense forces beyond the 1,000-mile limit from the homeland, it is time that we got everybody together and cards on the table, say to everybody else, hey, let's all share in providing for our common security here in the Asia-Pacific. ASEAN should be seen as one block. Whereas, as a group, it's very capable. You take the individual countries like the Philippines, our defense forces and our police forces are really I will not describe it by saying weak. No, they're just minimal, just enough. But looking at Singapore, Malaysia, Japan, with the biggest defense budget outside of China in our region, but not yet fully exercised, we could have a new security network covering all of us, similar to the old CETO of the early 50s, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. At that time, the common enemy was communism. It was during the height of the Cold War. This time, it is international terrorism that's the common enemy. Because any outbreak of that anywhere, here, Indonesia, Manila, will affect the whole region, especially in terms of the economy. And therefore, in the end, it will be the poor people that will be hurt the most. It's here. It's just one man's opinion, but at least it got printed. So.
And we will be putting all of these on our website, either the Pacific Forum website or CSIS. Mr. President?
Here's some more on the Boa Forum, Ralph. Yeah.
There's so many questions out there. I thought what I would do is maybe take two or three questions at a time, and then you can sort of pick and choose from them so that everyone gets a chance to ask them if that's
okay.
And I want this gentleman and then in the back.
My name's Steve Fowler. I'm the son-in-law of late Brigadier General Jess De La Cruz, PMA 57. In the last few years, Senator Pimentel and others have recommended that the Philippines change their constitution to more of a federal system. And I was wondering if your opinion, if you believe that a federal system would bring more stability, economic and political stability to the Philippines.
Yeah, President Ramos, Julian Baum. I used to be a journalist, and I used to be in Subic Bay of the naval forces there. I'd like to ask you to comment on what strikes me as a major change in attitude among China's neighbors towards China in recent years. You mentioned in your remarks about China's peaceful rise. It seems 10 years ago or more, China's neighbors were very suspicious and even fearful of China. But today, there seems to be willingness to give it the benefit of the doubt, with the possible exception of Japan. How do you account for this change? Is it purely economic, or is there more to it than just the economy? Thank you.
Bob, I'm going to give you. And then I'm going to take a second round.
President Ramos, I'm Larry Nix from the Congressional Research Service. Major point of contention between the U.S. and China is Japan's emerging security role in the region, which you alluded to. And part of that contention is China's accusation that the United States has been silent in addressing China's claim that Japan is not addressing its history, its historical record of the last century. The Philippine government has also been relatively silent about this issue as well. And I know that you and your generation of Filipinos know a lot about this issue. Would you have any advice for the Philippine government and also for U.S. officials in terms of how we should address this issue of how Japan is dealing with its historical record?
Okay, I'll try to cover all of those. First of all, on charter change, the big debate in the Philippines now is about charter change. Looking at the recent past, it's been very hot for the last 3 years, even before the elections of 2004. But it's not really that new as an issue. I campaigned on charter change back in late 1991 and 1992. And I was supported by the so-called parliamentary bloc of congressmen. It's about 40 of them in a house of 205 minority. Because of the need, as I saw it myself, to have decisions made faster in terms of legislative reforms. And I could see this happen faster in the parliamentary system. less expense on the part of candidates running for high national offices, so that they will not have to be voted upon by the entire electorate. 20 years ago, the electorate numbered 36 million people in a population of almost 70. And now that electorate is about 42 million in a population of 85 million. And so for a senator or vice president or even president campaigning countrywide, where you have 42 million voters expecting to shake your hand, expecting to be given a sandwich, or to be given a photo ops and a copy of that picture, or at least to be patted on the back, is just too much physically and financially, as well as time-wise, on the part of any candidate for national office. In fact, since our 24 senators are elected countrywide, not by state, not by district, all of them think they should be the next president or vice president once they win, except one. And that person has a higher ambition, and that is to become the Pope. But anyway, that's another story. But you see the relationship immediately between the incumbent president and a high-ranking senator would be one of competition and confrontation most of the time, instead of teamwork and synergy. So this is one reason for the parliamentary. The other one is the leadership in legislative and executive functions that takes place in the parliamentary system. We need to train more young leaders to be there at the very top, to run government, to run departments and ministries. But that opportunity is not really available to an ordinary young man with certain ambitions, even if he's very bright and very capable, because of the cost of running for national level elections. But running within a district or a constituency would give him that person the opportunity to go all the way to the top. Now, as you know, in the parliamentary system, you're elected for the first time as an MP, and maybe you are made also assistant bureau chief in the post office. But then, next time you move up higher in another ministry, and so forth and so on. So, what did I see in London in 1995? I met the shadow prime minister, leader of the opposition, by the name of Tony Blair, all of age 43, in his early 40s, waiting and watching for the chance to become the prime minister. And sure enough, in 3 years, he was the prime minister at age 46. The same is true for John Major, his predecessor. And now, the shadow prime minister in the UK, recently announced leader of the Conservative Party, is a young man of 39 years old by the name of David Cameron. Germany is led by a young lady, 51 years old, by the name of Angela Merkel. That sort of thing is happening around the world. Now, but one key reason, in so far as the Philippine context is concerned, is that if the government is not performing, corrupt, or just plain replaceable, the opposition, or those against the incumbent, need not invoke the intervention of the armed forces and the national police in the exercise, but only through a no confidence vote in government or about government in parliament will work. Of course, there's also such a thing as a confidence vote. Koizumi won that one. Schroeder lost it. I think in the case of Thaksin, well, there's no decision yet. But see, it was the armed forces and the police that kept these quarreling politicians apart instead of themselves becoming involved. In the case of the Philippines, we have had two narrow escapes already, February 86 and January 2001, under the so-called People Power Revolution. But why should we risk another one? And we came very close to that only end of February, under the present system that we have. As an old soldier, I am the first one that would say, never again. Now, in regard to, let me address this one first, China, Japan. Of course, we are not big power brokers in the Philippines, but we try hard to get the two heavyweights to team up together. What I mentioned about the new security umbrella is one mechanism where they can team up together for everybody's benefit. We're also saying that we have, as many other countries in South Asia have done, put World War II in the background, although we have not neglected the interests of the so-called comfort women, who are now in their 80s and 90s, who suffered at the hands of the Japanese during World War II. But we're saying, hey, Japan is our best ally in terms of official development assistance consistently over the years. It still is in terms of total support to the countries of Southeast Asia. The U.S. is coming up very strong in that regard, but so is China. So is the EU. And I think if we can get the two of them to see it that way, it will be all the better for all countries. Now, the Boa Forum is in a especially good position to do this sort of thing, to be some kind of a referee between the two big Asian powers. Case in point was last year when the thing broke out afresh, looking at about April 2005, because of the visit of Prime Minister Koizumi at the Yasukuni Shrine, and the thing erupted again. In the meantime, the leaders, including those of Japan and China, were in Jakarta celebrating the 50th anniversary of Afro-Asian Unity, hosted by the Indonesian government. But some of them were scheduled to be speakers in the Boa Forum, which was taking place concurrently. And so these leaders just shuttled back and forth between Jakarta and Boa to express their respective positions. But the majority of the leaders of other countries, third countries, the CEOs of multinationals, including Chinese and Japanese and Indians and Americans, plus academic experts, were saying that, hey, you two guys should get together already because we must think of the future. And any shooting war, any violence between the two of you is going to hurt not only you, but the rest of the region and the rest of the world, because economic interaction, economic growth even, might be paralyzed. That's our position over there. And I think if we relate it to the economic, cultural, educational, and people empowerment issues for the future, we can move along quite well in regard to the conflict between those two countries. We'll have to factor in Korea also in this aspect, because Korea is also very aggrieved, and we don't blame them, of course. But so are we. We're no longer aggrieved against the Americans. But you must remember, U.S. military forces have invaded, occupied, and administered only two countries in its history. The first is Iraq, or one is Iraq. But the first one was the Philippines 105 years ago, and it took you 12 long years to pacify the whole country, including the Muslim South. So, in the end, you know, let's look to the future. Now, in regard to this question over here, if I heard it correctly, but please repeat it if I didn't get it totally. If you're talking about the U.S. bases, is that the one?
No, sir.
I'm sorry.
Talking about the change in attitude towards China by its neighbors. Ten years ago, Southeast Asians were very suspicious and even fearful of China. But today, you seem to give Beijing the benefit of the doubt. Why for the change?
Why so nice to China?
Well, again, it's a matter of common interest. We need to export from where we are. The Southeast Asia is a big exporting country, including high-tech products, like us, semiconductors. It's not just bananas and pineapples. The same for Indonesia, the same for Malaysia, the same for Singapore, same for Thailand, although in the case of Singapore, it's all high-tech products and services. On the part of China, well, they have a growing middle class, growing at the rate of maybe 15% a year, who can now save their own hard currency, put up their own savings account, exit from the country without too much documentation, and travel and spend, just like American tourists. And thirdly, I think that there is a very strong cultural bond between China and Southeast Asians. Looking at just the Philippines, among the top 10 tycoons in the Philippines are 6 Filipino Chinese, whose fathers or grandfathers came from the very poor province of Fujian during those days. But as poor boys, they made good in the Philippines, you see. And so it's natural for the descendants, second and third generations, for now Filipino citizens to go back there and try to invest there, create some business opportunities there. And if that's true for the Philippines, even more true for Thailand, Singapore and Malaysia, and Indonesia also. Anyway, I think within the next generation, look at 20, 25 years, we're seeing that this cooperation will continue in the same way that we hope the cooperation that already exists between the countries of both sides of the Pacific, meaning the U.S., Canada, all the way down to the NAFTA area, and the Philippines especially, and the east side of Asia, will also continue. Let's not forget, before the advent of United Airlines or American Airlines or Pan American or Cathay Pacific or Philippine Airlines, you had only one transportation company working. And it worked for 250 years. This was the one between Manila as the entry port of entry for China, Japan, Southeast Asia, from Manila by galleon to Acapulco. Looking at the late 16th century up to the mid-19th century, 250 years. And a lot of goodwill was generated during that time. And there were some little watering stations along the way on the California coast. Manila was already the center of a big Spanish colonial empire in Asia, but there were little watering stations called San Francisco, Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And that's how they grew, because of the Manila-Acapulco galleon trade. And the goods that went that way went on to Europe, first overland from Acapulco to Veracruz, from Veracruz on the Atlantic side, to Madrid, to London, etc., etc. So with this background, there really should be no more wars and confrontations going on. If we only could attend to the common enemy, which is international terrorism, which is mindless, it does not respect any borders. The international terrorists do not represent any country or community. Then I think we'll be much better off.
Very quick, 30-second question. This gentleman is next.
Angel Rabasa from the RAND Corporation. Mr. President, it's a privilege to have you here. One of your important accomplishments during your administration was to negotiate the agreement with the MNLF. And I would like, would be interested in your thoughts on what needs to be done to address the current security situation in Mindanao. And specifically, given your experience in the negotiations at the time, what needs to be done to bridge the gap that still remains between the Philippine government and the MILF that I understand has narrowed considerably lately?
This gentleman right here, Catherine, the last question, and then I'll give you as long as you can spare to spend with us to answer.
Sir, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity, sir. Henry Bensurta from the Philippine Embassy.
Sir, kita marinig. Sige, charge mo.
Sir, my question, sir, refers to your idea of your preferred approach of dealing with the emerging China in the region, sir. I was just wondering, sir, whether you could put more flesher into that idea in terms of specifics, noting, sir, that economics can be a double-edged sword in the sense that while it can be a very good form of settling disputes or provoking cooperation, on the one hand, it could also be a means or could start a friction, and we've seen this as the competition for resources grows, and we've seen how China has reacted in terms of its need for energy, that it could also be a source of friction. So my question, sir, there is there a way of managing this to make sure that in the future that would not happen, sir? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Henry. The question of Angel, you know, he knows the answer to that, but we exchange notes all the time. But, one more?
I'm Catherine Del Pino from Georgetown University. As you know, the Philippines will host the East Asian Summit this December in Cebu, and there's discussion in Washington about whether we missed the boat, and if we did, what sort of a boat it is. Would you counsel the United States to try and join the summit?
You're talking about the ASEAN summit?
East Asian summit.
This one first, and then the two are really related. But the problem in Mindanao arose out of the breaking of the ceasefire that had already been forced between the MILF that lasted for 30 months after it was forced in July 1997. You may recall that I created a government MILF peace panel because the MILF as a splinter group did not totally agree with the peace accord with the MNLF because they felt left out. Well, they were left out because they were talking about creating a independent Bangsa Moro Republic. So how can, you know, we couldn't allow that. But the MNLF agreed to the expanded economy. One feature of the peace accord with the MNLF was especially admired by the OIC, in that we accommodated, if they were qualified under the law, 7,500 former mujahideens into our armed forces and national police, including a former general, who, by the way, became governor of Sulu by election later on. To me, not because I was in the forefront of that, it was a very good peace agreement. But the MLF, to satisfy them, we immediately went into a separate peace agreement. But the ceasefire was broken in April year 2000, Mr. Estrada's time, when he ordered an all-out attack on Camp Abu Bakar, thinking that the MLF was growing too big and unmanageable. But at that stage, let me tell you something which is not written about much. But the chairman of our government panel, retired General Orlando Soriano, former commander of the Southern Command, also concurrently head of National Irrigation, in July 1997, came to me and said, "Sir, Chairman Hashim Abu Bakar wants three things from the government." So what's that? "Oh, water system for 5,000 families. So I said, "Well, go ahead. We can put that up with the use of solar power, which we had just acquired, to activate the pumps to bring up the water, and then you put up the system. You are National Irrigation Commissioner, and that's your sector, water. So what else?" "Sir, he wants us to irrigate 2,500 hectares or 5,000 acres in Camp Abu Bakar." So I said, "Can you do it?" "Yes, sir. We have the main water coming in about 6 months from 15 kilometers away. But we can start digging the secondary tunnels to distribute the water in the rice fields." "Okay, go ahead. What else?" "Sir, they want us to pave the road from the main highway, 15 kilometers, into their center of Camp Abu Bakar." By the way, that is a community. It's not a camp like the Pentagon. No, it's a big, big community. 1,800 hectares. Big. Very big. So I said, "You mean to tell me they want that old muddy road that only foot soldiers can traverse to be paved, and therefore our artillery, our armor, our tanks even can go in there?" "Yes, sir, that's what they want." "So, what's your analysis of this?" "Only," I asked General Soriano. "Sir, they just want to be recognized and be given the credit. And I do not think they want to really become independent. They just want greater autonomy." So I said, "Can you do the road? Can you do the irrigation?" "Yeah, I can do it because that's my job. Never mind the Department of Public Works. I have the machinery. It's just a small road." I said, "Go ahead. How much do you need?" "Oh, 100 million pesos. "Okay. It's worth it." I said, "You can have 50 million first. Here, take it. And come back to me in 3 months, report the progress, you have the rest of it." And that's the way we talked. And that ceasefire lasted for 2 years and a half. But in the next administration, well, I guess there are reasons for the decision, but the result to us, the is spreading again of the violence throughout Mindanao, instead of just being confined maybe in three or four communities where the authorities were already mapping up because there was a peace agreement. But now, there has been a continuous ceasefire for the last 2 years since Malaysia came in as the chairman of the Committee of the Eight. And so, they're saying that it would work. Now, on the last two questions, well, I really have answered them peripherally, talking about the other questions. But how do we handle it? Well, be sure you are engaged. Do not isolate them. Stay with them. But be engaged in a productive way that is mutually beneficial. And this is what we have now. Our people are trying to learn Mandarin, trying to attract their tourists. They want our teachers to go there to teach them English, and they want to buy our bananas, etc., etc. There are so many common things going on. So, stay with it. Now here, there's a special focus here that I'd like you to repeat. Okay.
Whether the United States should try to join the East Asian Summit.
Yeah.
Which would mean signing the Treaty of Amity.
The for me personally, and I think for the Philippines, although I don't speak for the Philippines, it would be a welcome addition to the EAS, because you're there anyway. You're in the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, you're in APEC, and we're all there together. And so what else is new? Besides, the ASEAN Dialogue Partners consist of the same people almost. And you will note that in the Manila Conference of Ministers in July 1992, my time, that was where we forged the so-called Manila Declaration on the islands of the South China Sea, to which the U.S., China, and Japan adhered, meaning peaceful diplomatic resolutions of any disputes therein. No more surprises, no more mischief reefs, etc., although the mischief reefs came later. But that led to the code of conduct between the Philippines and China, 1994, and also the code of conduct between Vietnam and China on our encouragement the next year. And now it's an ASEAN plus China code of conduct. And since the U.S. is there in a very big way in terms of the presence of the U.S. Pacific Fleet guaranteeing safe passage, safe navigation, there's every reason for the U.S. to be included in the East Asian Summit.
Okay.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Here's one more.
It's not unusual for people in Washington to ask good, direct questions. It is unusual to get good, direct answers. And we very much appreciate your actually responding to the questions and providing us with a lot of good information. We will try to capture as much of this as possible, get it on our website. If you've left your business card or email address with us, we will make sure you get a copy. If you don't have a business card, we take Visa, MasterCard, Express. Happy to take those as well. And again, Mr. President.
Well, thank you, Ralph, and all the best to your people here in CSIS. And I'm adding one more. This is what I'll be putting into the Manila Bulletin on the 23rd of May. So that's still a long way off, but that means I'm ahead in doing my homework, unlike some people in Malacanang, you know. And this is about the proposed anti-terrorism law in the Philippines, being debated since 1994. And in the meantime, 9/11 took place, Jakarta bombings, Bali bombings, the Valentine Day bombings in the Philippines took place, so we're still waiting for this to come out. And the companion piece here is Bali Revisited, talking about the ASEAN EPG and the events in Bali, October 2002, October 2005, deadly bombings again. But now Indonesia has the legal tools that can make the authorities, the investigators, the intelligence, the police, the armed forces even, more effective in providing for public safety. So what are we waiting for in the Philippines? Anyway,
thank you, Mr. President.
So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.